Welcome all to another episode of A Positive Podcast. Today's episode is a little different than my usual format. I have the privilege of sharing with you all a conversation between my husband, Rabbi Nechemia Shusterman, and a psychiatrist, Dr. Craig Heacock, who also happens to be a host of a very popular podcast called Back from the Abyss, which has been named one of the top 10 psychedelic podcasts. And it's a fascinating conversation between Dr. Heacock and my husband, and they discuss a variety of topics from medications and mood disorders and the importance of sleep and exercise, as well as other questions that come up as they are speaking. I think that you will find this to be an interesting conversation. Although it may be data heavy and a lot of information, I think everyone will gain insight and education and awareness that will be helpful for you personally and for you to share with others. So sit back, relax, and be ready to listen and grow. In addition, I want to share with you all that if you're curious to find out more about my positive psychology-based coaching, you can reach out to me at my website at apositivecoach.com, or you can email me at Raizel, R-A-I-Z-E-L, at jewishpeabody.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Welcome to another positive podcast. And today we have the privilege and honor of having Dr. Craig Heacock. Dr. Craig Heacock is an adolescent and adult psychiatrist and addiction specialist in Colorado, as well as co-producer and host of the psychiatric storytelling podcast, Back from the Abyss. He was a therapist in the phase 3 trial of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD and has particular interest in the use of ketamine and other psychedelics to treat severe mood disorders and PTSD. He's a graduate of the University of New Mexico School of Medicine and did his psychiatry training at Brown University. A friend of mine turned me onto your podcast this summer, and I found them, well, at times, you know, pretty intense because you do get into some really, really heavy-duty stuff. And for those who want to go there, you can, check his podcast out at Back from the Abyss. It's a fascinating podcast, but today we're going to keep the topic a tad more tame. But if you want to get into some really deep, deep, dark mental health conversations, just scroll back and listen to some of the earlier podcasts. And the only other preface that I'll give before I jump into the questions is, you know, one of the things that I found really, really fascinating in listening to your podcast is that you take a really broad, comprehensive approach, almost like if one could call it, you know, forensic psychiatry, where you don't just say, okay, so, you know, someone's coming in with symptoms, they feel depression, they feel anxiety, but really you'll look deeper, you know, what's going on in your blood, what's going on in, you know, your hormones, what other contributing factors? I mean, there is all the other stuff, traumas, and you know, there are biochemical components, but you explore deeper. And I think, you know, in a certain way, our society today has just been trained that there's a pill for everything. Walk in, I feel this ailment, whether it's a physical ailment or a mental ailment, and just give me the pill that will solve the problem. And we know that it doesn't always work. And there's reasons why it doesn't always work, whether the diagnosis is wrong or whether you know, we're not treating the real issue. We're only trying to get at the symptoms. And I like your comprehensive approach at looking at the entire picture, you know, kind of like, you know, that book, you know, the boy who was raised as a dog, you know, he is truly, I think, a forensic psychiatrist. You're like another modern day version of that concept. And I found it really interesting. So I want people to, you know, do as I hope that I do for my own self and my family, which is, you know, don't just, you know, follow the herd. You know, if you have a situation that you're dealing with yourself, your children, your family members, whatever, to really look at the whole picture, not to just say, okay, this is the ailment, let's treat it like everyone's doing it, but let's try to broaden our horizon and look at it from a more expansive view. So with that as a background, let's jump right into this. Why don't we start by telling us a little about yourself, your background, and how you got to this very popular podcast, Back from the Abyss.
Yeah. Well, this is my third career. I was a high school teacher for 3 years, and then I got a master's and did environmental work, and then went back to med school when I was 30 to be a psychiatrist. That was a goal. It's kind of a long story, but the short of the podcast really came about from my own personal pain, some of the vicarious trauma I've experienced being a psychiatrist also my love of podcasts, and also a couple of my patients who for years have been saying, I want to share my story with the world. So the woman, Elizabeth, from season one, episode one, Strawberries is that episode. She'd been saying to me for years, like, I feel like I have things of my story that could give some hope and inspiration to people. And when I decided to do the podcast, I called her and I said, you're episode one. And she said, yes, please, please. And so that was the first one we recorded. That's a very heavy 5 chili rating episode. I don't know if you've listened to it. My kids have said, Dad, you should put a little warning on that one. But it is a completely engrossing story. And then episode, I think 3 is a guy, Chris, and same thing. He had been saying for years, I want to get my story out. And so it's kind of this synergy of, oh, I have people who want to share their story. I think I can help them. I love podcasts. And then also I wanted to kind of weave in some of my own stuff. Like, I've had now 9 suicides and 2 murders. I've had a couple of the suicides in particular were just brutal for me. And one sent me spiraling down a path of addiction for a while. And so I've weaved that into the podcast too, kind of my own journey into the abyss and out, and then my patients as well. And in season one, most of the storytellers were my patients, but now largely people are approaching me, which is fun. I have a woman flying out from New York City next week. She's going to meet with me and tell her story, come to my office. So it's been even more meaningful than I would have ever hoped.
Would you say that, on some level, you're a wounded healer, and wounded healers make better doctors, make better caretakers?
Yeah. We actually did a couple episodes on that where we looked at this question. Do you have to have your own darkness to be an effective therapist? And I think it helps. I think I was a solid doc and therapist before I had my own plunge into darkness, but I think I came out with a whole new level of humility and just compassion towards others and myself. And I think that, you know, the darkness is coming. That's one of the messages of Back from the Abyss. Like, you may not have some terrible mental health plunge, but, you know, life is going to throw really hard things at us, whether it's divorce or mental illness in a child or loss of a family member. And so we need to get ready for that. You know, and I think that I would argue the way we get ready for that is we pull together, we connect, we become as resilient as we can be. And, you know, that's another way to look at Back from the Abyss. I think these are stories of resilience. These are people that plunged into horrible places and were able to find that inner strength to pull out and come to the other side.
Oh, that's fascinating. I love the idea of fortifying yourself and building up resilience. Not so much a part of preparing for imminent darkness or eventual darkness, but, you know, please God, we can be spared that. But indeed, if it does come, we're better off if we're a little bit fortified and prepared for that. All right, so let me jump into some more of the technical stuff. Okay, so one of the things that I found really fascinating about your podcast, as I mentioned before, is that you take this whole approach, you know, this larger, you know, you kind of zoom out and then you explore the patient, you know, in their entirety. You know, they're coming in, yes, of course, with specific symptoms. Let's keep it, you know, relatively mild, something that I don't know what the specific statistics are, but something that many Americans, many humans are dealing with, you know, depression, anxiety. And, you know, usually they're given some pill and, you know, said, okay, you know, wait, you know, if it's a quick pill, because you did a whole podcast on medications. I thought that was really fascinating. I now know a little bit, you know, if it's a benzo, it's a fast acting, you know, if it's an SSRI, it takes a little more time to build up. But the point is that they're given a medication and told wait a day, wait a week, wait a month, but you should start feeling better. I like how you, and then we find often that it doesn't work out that way. So, you know, we know that there's incorrect diagnosis, wrong diagnoses, wrong medications, hormonal, you know, imbalances, whether testosterone, you know, estrogen. And often these are the causes for the mental health challenges that people are going through. So tell me more about that. How come you're not just doing what everyone else is doing?
I think that goes back to an attending I worked with at Brown my first year. And remember, he gave us a seminar the first year residence. He said, look, there's 2 ways to really think of practicing as a psychiatrist. He said, let's imagine that humans exist on a continuum of -5 to +5. So -5 would be severe disabling psychiatric symptoms, let's call them. 0 would be no symptoms. +5 would be optimal functioning, health, connection, love, meaning, joy. He said, so there is a whole current in psychiatry, which is very symptom focused. This is med management. These are the people who are quote unquote psychopharmacologists, which I think is one of the scariest things happening in psychiatry now, that people are literally just becoming like fertilizer managers. Like, we're only going to deal with chemicals. But he said, so there are psychiatrists and schools of thought in psychiatry that the goal is to get people to 0, meaning no symptoms. He said, but that is not what you should be doing. That is not the meaningful work. That is not the beautiful work. That is not what psychiatry can be and should be. You should be aiming for +5. So, and then another attending, I remember right around that same time, I was talking to him about all the schools of psychotherapy or CBT and psychodynamic and existential. And I said, how do you approach a patient? And he said, you know, think of it this way. We all want an algorithm. It would be, in some ways, it'd be nice if everybody could be a like paint by number. And that's kind of what symptom focused psychiatry is. He said, but imagine every patient is a painting. And he says, imagine a course of treatment is you're meeting the patient and you're painting together. You're picking the colors and the brushes and the strokes and the medium, and you're co-creating this thing. And he said, it is beautiful and it's complicated and it's messy, but in the end, it's so much better by paint than paint by number. He said, so do you want to be a paint by number psychiatrist? I said, no. And so I think about those two attendings a lot, just, and this was in the first year, just thinking that, there's the chance with each patient to really create something novel and tailored to them that fits in with who they are. Because, you know, if you met 10 of my patients with the same diagnosis and talked to each of them, you'd probably be shocked how different each of them is. Like, how could each of these person have the same, you know, axis one psychiatric diagnosis? Well, it's because the psychiatric diagnostic classifications are a mess, a total mess, which is a whole other topic. So it's not really helpful to think of people as just, oh, this person has depression or this person has anxiety. I mean, that's the start. You know, I think ideally, as we get to know them, we understand why, where did this come from? And excuse me, I did an episode on that, I think last year, where I looked at the whole idea of depression as a syndrome. A lot of people think of depression as a diagnosis. It's not a diagnosis. It's a syndrome. It's a final common pathway. There's 1,000 ways to that pathway. And again, I think traditional symptom-focused medication management is, okay, what are your symptoms? Okay, your energy's low. Your libido's low. You're having panic. Okay, we're going to give you meds to treat those symptoms, try to bring you up to 0. But I think people who practice the way I do, which is sometimes called integrative psychiatry, although I would just call it good psychiatry. I think good psychiatry looks at the whole person and is interested in how is your marriage? How's your sexual relationship? What was it like to be a little child in your home? How much do you exercise? What time do you wake up in the morning? How, you know, although you have to understand all that to really understand somebody's, how they're presenting in your office and their, you know, symptoms, if you will.
You're jumping ahead to a bunch of the questions that I'm going to be asking you, but it's interesting because one of the things you said actually really resonated really interestingly with me. My wife is a positive psychology practitioner and the whole, I mean, I'm not going to pretend to understand everything about her training because she did it, not me. But I know that one of the fundamentals of it is we're not trying to get from beneath even to even, we're trying to be beyond, like you said, +5. We're trying to get to better than we are. And then occasionally we may dip down. But so in that way, that concept certainly resonates and seems to make a whole lot more sense than a lot of the other stuff that's going on. Would you say that doctors are just diagnosing quickly because they're in a rush and there's, you know, the numbers of people struggling are greater than ever before. And the pandemic has thrown gas on top of that fire. So people just got to get patients in and out, get them in, get them out, you know, just because we don't have time.
Yeah. I think it's complicated. There's a few factors. One is that there's such a shortage of mental health professionals, particularly psychiatrists, that there is great pressure to see more people, to practice in this sort of symptom focused thing. It's much easier if you just focus on symptoms. I know psychiatrists who literally give their patients a symptom checklist in the waiting room. They bring it in. The psychiatrist looks at the symptom checklist and like, okay, we're going to up your Zoloft and then we're going to cut your clonidine and then you're going to come back in 3 weeks. And then that's it. That's their med management, 12-minute visit, looking at the symptom checklist. And, you can reach more people that way. It's much easier, but you're missing so much. But the problem is, again, there's a huge shortage of psychiatrists in the US. If everybody was doing what I'm doing, the shortage would be even more disastrous. So that's the irony. It's like, I feel like the psychiatrists who are trying to work more holistically, whole person, you have to spend a lot more time with people. And so you can see many fewer people, which would just exacerbate the shortage. So, and I've talked about that on my podcast. Like, I'm not trying to beat up on the med management psychiatrists. I think they do fill an important role. It's not good care. It's bare bones care. Like if you're seeing your psychiatrist for 12 and a half minutes or if your psychiatrist calls himself or herself a psychopharmacologist, I think you should run. And imagine if, you got a landscape architect or something, they came out to your house like, well, really, I'm just a fertilizer manager. What? Like I specialize in fertilizers for your soil. I mean, that's not what you want. You want somebody who sees the bigger picture. So that's part of it. And the other thing is it's the way the DSM, the diagnostic manual is set up. It's very tempting to fall into just checking boxes like, okay, you have this, check, check, check. Thus you have this. And that's the way we're trained. So, but then there's this other whole school of thought of like, no, that's just the surface level. So there's this real schism in psychiatry training of, should we think about people as symptoms or should we do whole person? And it seems like obviously be whole person, but even if you think about med school, we're trained as doctors first and doctors about symptoms. So that's the other strange dynamic. Psychiatrists are MDs who do this additional training. And so we're really trained in the disease model, the medical model, the symptom model, the differential diagnosis model, but psychiatry is not like that. I would argue shouldn't be like that at all.
But I totally get the conflict. On one hand, we need more doctors than them. We don't have, if every psychiatrist was spending that much time, we'd have an even greater shortage. So I get that. So let's talk to some, maybe through this podcast, some people can be helped. Let's go with the most common diagnoses, anxiety, depression. I mean, you could throw in more diagnoses if you wish to talk about it. Let's talk about some of the less known but pretty common contributors to these things that people don't even think about, whether it's exercise, diet, hormonal imbalances. I know you did a whole podcast on that, but let's give a nutshell version of that.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should start with sleep because anybody who listens to Back from the Abyss knows that I'm a true believer in sleep. And so it turns out that sleep and mood are inextricably linked. In fact, I would argue that you really can't have a meaningful mood disorder like bipolar disorder or depression unless you have sleep disturbance. Sleep and mood are not even like peanut butter and jelly. They're closer than that. I'd say they are, they're almost one in some really profound ways. So one of the things I focus most on with patients, and I've talked a lot about in the podcast, is you have to get your sleep under control. Let me define that. So more and more in modern society, we're living like nocturnal mammals. We stay up very late. We have a lot of bright screen and light access. A lot of people sleep late. We are not true to our biological roots, which is if you look at all the hormonal systems of the brain, the way our sleep cycle is supposed to work is it's supposed to be on a light dark cycle. So it turns out not shockingly, not shockingly that when people sleep in the dark and get up when the sun comes up, they feel immensely better. And in fact, for many cases of mild to moderate depression, simply committing to a healthy sleep schedule will pull people out of that. Not necessarily as true with severe depression. So what do we see with the classic thing we see with depression is people stay up late, sleep late. And so it turns out waking up a few hours after your ideal time, it wrecks all your hormones. It leads to.
And let me interrupt you for a second before you continue. When you say being a diurnal person, you know, waking up a day, it doesn't matter if it's sunny outside or rainy. And is it about the clock and the time, or is it about little actual exposure to the sun? Because I remember hearing someone telling me that there's natural melatonin that you get from the sun. I don't know if that's real, but at least I've heard.
Yeah, I meant being on a circadian rhythm where you're waking up the same time every day after, you know, shortly after the sun comes up. So it turns out that, and I did an episode on this where I've been testing this hypothesis for years. People come into my office first session. I say, what time do you wake up in the morning? That one question can lay out a whole treatment plan for them. Because what a healthy person says, psychiatrically, psychologically healthy person says, oh, I get up most every morning 6:30 to 7 or 7 to 7:30 or 5:45 to 6:45. There's a short window. It's the same time every day. And it's right around the time the sun comes up or shortly thereafter. What do depressed people say? Well, I don't have a wake up time. Or I sleep from noon to 4, or I get up anywhere between 8 and 2. So what I tell people, so basically they're on 6 time zones. So imagine anybody who's traveled and knows what jet lag is. You know, if your wake up time varies between 7 and 10 a.m., that's like saying some days I wake up in LA, then New York, then Chicago, then Denver. And you just, so what would that feel like if you did that? You would be irritable, foggy, have learning and memory and focus problems, probably have some either, if not just irritable, but depressed mood. You would not feel well. But that people do that all the time. But then that's not even counting the factoring in all the hormonal influences. So I spend a lot of time with people initially looking at this idea that if you can't get your sleep on track, it's everything else we do. It's going to be extremely difficult.
So let me ask, before we jump into the hormonal stuff, for some people, you know, if it's just about, I like watching a certain TV show that's only on at a certain hour, you know, train yourself to DVR it or do something so that you can, but some people just have trouble sleeping, maybe because of that very same anxiety or insomnia. I mean, I know that's all interlinked. Sometimes it's easier said than done. And sometimes, sometimes it's control yourself and, you know, follow more structured lifestyle, or as you call it, the circadian rhythm. And sometimes it's easier said than done. The people just can't get on rhythm.
Right.
It's like, which came first, the chicken or the egg, but they're still having trouble sleeping.
Yeah. But what's so interesting, and this is not always true, but it's most always true, is I ask people to commit to a wake up time. And I say, okay, let's try to find a semi-healthy wake up time. And I tell them, get up then, no matter what, whether you're laying in bed all night, whether you were up for 3 hours, whether you slept well. And people will report they feel significantly better having a regular wake up time, even if they have a terrible night, versus, oh, my alarm went off at 7. I'm going to snooze it till 9 a.m. and get 2 more hours sleep and catch up on my sleep. No, you will feel fatigued, more depressed, more foggy, more cloudy, inevitably. Like, I often tell my patients that I could take a healthy, happy person off the street at Fort Collins, bring them to my house, and simply by keeping them up late and having them sleep late, I could make them fatigued, cloudy. And if they have a predisposition to depression, I could push them into that just by altering their sleep schedule.
That's fascinating. That's incredible. We know the value of sleep, but this is clearly putting, you know, I think people can try it, you know?
Yeah. Right. It's not just sleep, but it's when you sleep. Like, it's completely different to sleep from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. versus 4 a.m. to noon. They're both 8 hours. You sleep 4 a.m. to noon, you are not going to be a healthy, functioning person.
That is interesting. Okay, let's pivot over to hormones. I know you mentioned that on a recent podcast, and I found that fascinating. You mentioned for both males and females, but I remember you said for women, when they go through the three major times in their lives when they go through major hormonal changes, that throws the whole body out of whack. Tell us more about that and how that works with men as well. Mm-hmm.
So women have, at least in the US, 2 to 2.5 times as much clinically severe depression and anxiety as men. surely there are some sociological factors, some cultural factors, but the number one factor for sure is hormones. And as you just mentioned, you know, when do women fall apart psychiatrically? It's after they get their menses in early adolescence, it's postpartum, it's perimenopause and menopause. And that is because those are when they're big hormonal shifts and transitions. And there's this belief in, I think it's not just in society, I think in medicine for a lot of people that hormone replacement is unnecessary, that it's potentially dangerous, that we should just let women move through the life cycle, and that menopause is actually a good thing for a lot of women.
Maybe we're messing with God's master plan.
Right, right. But the point on the episode that you're referring to, as I said, you know, for most of human history, there was no menopause. We were dead long before menopause. And there's only four other species on the planet that have menopause. Interestingly, they're all toothed whales. And there are some interesting sort of evolutionary theories why we might have menopause. But I think the short of it is we have menopause because of public health and modern healthcare. Because what menopause represents is the burnout of the ovaries. It represents the slow withering of the hormonal system of women. And men have the same thing. It's called andropause. But the gist of it is that men in their 40s and women in their 40s start losing their sex hormones. And for a lot of men and women, that has serious psychiatric complications, including depression and fatigue and lethargy and anxiety and panic and insomnia and even suicidal thinking and behaviors. So years ago, I got on board with this, and I used to try to coordinate with primary care docs saying, hey, you should start hormones on this person. And there's so much kickback. And for years, I was on the phone with primary care docs and gynecologists like, oh no, this person doesn't need hormone replacement therapy. No, 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 no. And I said, no, psychiatrically they need it. And so finally I just started doing it myself, did some training on that. And so for most of my patients who are on hormone replacement, I do it because just such kickback in the medical community. And I think it's because I think the most doctors don't, and even a lot of psychiatrists, sadly, don't understand how crucial it is to have baseline level of sex hormones to feel and function well. And it turns out a lot of folks with significant psychiatric illness from 40, 45 on, unless your hormones, your baseline level of sex hormones are adequate, psychiatric treatment essentially doesn't work. Like antidepressants don't work. You know, if you're menopausal for a lot of women and you're trying to treat their depression and they're not on hormone replacement, it's not going to do anything. So
it's interesting. Let me ask you this. Would you suggest for people who are feeling, you know, certainly as they're aging, well, young aging, I'm 45, but I fall into that category that you just said. But, you know, certainly if you're in your 40s or 50s, but if someone's in their teens or 20s or 30s, you know, would you suggest getting, you know, blood work done so you can actually check your levels of, you know, testosterone, estrogen, you know, if as part of a whole treatment plan of dealing with a psychiatric illness, anxiety, depression, panic, whatever?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, that's an interesting controversy in medicine too. There's a school of people who order labs and then treat the results. And then there's the other school, which I'm in, which is you don't order labs unless there's a patient's complaint or something that suggests you should. So for example, if I had a 48-year-old man come into my office and say, you know what, I just don't want to do anything. Like I've kind of lost all my drive and I don't really even want to have sex with my wife. And I just feel old. Like I don't feel well. I mean, first thing I would do is order testosterone levels. But you know, if a 32-year-old guy came, or even a 50-year-old guy came in my office, like check my testosterone, I'd say, tell me about that. How's your libido? How's your drive? How's your energy? How fast are you recovering from workouts? And if all those were negative, I would probably say, I don't think we should check that. Your sex drive's strong. You're training for a marathon. Your muscle mass is good. You have no depressive symptoms. Because I think we have to be careful just start ordering labs and trying to treat people by the numbers. And I think the same thing is true with women in perimenopause. You know, the hormonal testing is controversial. And that it can be very hard to interpret the results. I'm in the camp of people that if women are having symptoms that are consistent with low hormones, then to treat. And if they're not, I have menopausal women who say, oh, I feel fine. They're not on HRT. They feel good. They're not having current psychiatric symptoms. Like, okay, great. And again, it's tempting to have an algorithm or be all or nothing. But I think, again, you got to paint a picture for each person.
All right, let's jump back to the sleep just for one more second. What's your thoughts on sleep aids, melatonin, sleeping pills, Ambiens? I know there's stronger stuff out there than that.
Yeah. So few thoughts. Number one is anything that you take for sleep, you're going to build up tolerance to. Physiological tolerance and psychological tolerance and dependence. So you can become, like melatonin is a good example. Like if you're taking melatonin as a quite safe thing to take for sleep. But if you start taking it every night, you're going to become psychologically dependent on it. If you forgot it on a trip, you might have a lot of trouble sleeping just because you think, oh no, I don't have my melatonin. So I think sleep meds, for example, are used short term. That said, I have a lot of people on long-term sleep meds and they lose efficacy over time. So I think what we're always trying to do with sleep when people are on sleep meds is trying to figure out what's safest in case they need to be on it long-term. Because again, surprise, surprise, a ton of people I see have severe mood issues and mood and sleep are so tied together. So a significant percentage of people I see are going to probably be on some sleep medication into the foreseeable future because that's actually part of their whole psychiatric illness process. So, but you know, there are some sleep, like you mentioned Ambien, you know, Ambien is a fairly risky med, which if not taken properly can cause huge problems.
So you don't want people on it long-term, but you recognize that in certain scenarios it's necessary because it's mm-hmm. without it, you can't right the ship.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. You have somebody with, what's a good example? You have someone with clinically severe bipolar disorder, like they're probably going to be on some kind of sleep medication long-term because just the nature of their unstable moods, they're going to have unstable sleep. And the fastest way to decompensate with bipolar disorder is sleep deprivation. So.
And for example, in that scenario, it would be better to have them on a long-term sleep medication, but keep them level rather than, and the risk of long-term, not addiction, but need is outweighs the greater problem of the bipolar disorder going out of control.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's case by case. I have a lot of people, you know, who are on chronic sleep meds and we talk about that a lot. Okay. Here's the pluses of this. Here's the negatives. Because for some people, poor sleep is a great inconvenience. For some people, poor sleep is life-threatening. I mean, they could literally end up like in jail or dead. So for those people, we have to treat that pretty aggressively and have them on nightly sleep meds.
Understood. Okay. So let's move in a little bit of a different direction. Trauma. We keep on talking about, we're talking mostly about symptoms. You said something interesting in one of your podcasts that if there is a trauma, and I guess I'll build this into a couple of questions. Would you say that every psychiatric illness has a trauma related to it? And then you also mentioned, I know I'm throwing a couple questions together and like this, you can run with it wherever you want. You said if the trauma is not addressed, the medications will never work, at least not long-term. Mm-hmm. So where does trauma factor into all this? Has everyone been traumatized? A lot of people don't want to believe that. I don't want to believe that, but yeah. If that's the truth, you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would start by saying that trauma is a factor in many people who come to my office, but not everyone. So I work with plenty of people who, had a manic break in college or developed schizophrenia in late high school or developed panic disorder in their 30s and no apparent trauma. It's not super common, but I see people who have really severe depression who will say, I grew up in a loving, warm, stable home. I'm very close to my mom and dad. I had great teachers. I had a really beautiful childhood and now I want to die. So I think it's tempting. Again, we're always looking for things we can hang our hat on, like Gabor Mate. He says, oh, all addiction comes from trauma. Or, you know, a lot of the trauma specialists like will say all depression comes from trauma. Well, that's just not true. I think that the nuanced, more accurate statement is trauma is a factor in a lot of addiction. Trauma is a factor in a lot of depression. But there are people who don't have any meaningful trauma who develop serious psychiatric illness. And part of that, I think we can look at, if you look at the identical twin studies, most of the major psychiatric illnesses are 50 to 70% heritable, meaning if you take one identical twin, separate it from the other one at birth, there's 50 to 70% chance, depending on the illness, that if one develops the illness, the other will, which suggests that psychiatric illness has a significant, very significant genetic component, but it's not 100%. Environment's part of it too. So, trauma is a big factor, but I think one of the most interesting realizations I've had in the last few years is that for many people, the most significant trauma they've had is almost surely missed by most psychiatric providers and themselves. And let me say what that is that 0 to 3 emotional neglect, age 0 to 3. A ton of research shows now that is incredibly damaging to people, but that's very hard to evaluate for, because that might be the kind of thing like mom's super depressed, puts the baby in the crib and just leaves the baby in the crib all day, all night, gives it a bottle. But
and the baby can't speak up and tell you, right, hey, what happened to me.
Right. And so the baby, and I've actually had a couple of people on the podcast who turns out had this history. They only found out later in their lives that they just never understood why they couldn't connect and attach, and why they just felt this deep sense of fear and that things weren't right in the world. And then they found out later, oh, mom was, for example, super depressed and just left him in the crib 24/7 and bring him a bottle. So, you know, it's one thing to ask people about sexual trauma or physical trauma. I mean, mostly people can remember that.
Bullying, other things like that.
Bullying, right. But if you've had emotional neglect, particularly during those early years, baby toddler years, mom was absent, mom was alcoholic, mom was gone or depressed, or it's very difficult to evaluate for, but that is one of the most profound insults a person can have and sets them up for all sorts of psychiatric illness. So I've gotten a little better, I think, about thinking about that and evaluating for that, but that is not easy. Like you can't ask someone evaluation like, hey, do you think you were just left in the crib alone? Or do you think you were emotionally neglected by your parents when you were a little baby? Most people have no idea. It usually comes around to having to look at mom and dad's mental health history, how the other kids turned out.
It's a
forensic kind of evaluation.
Right. Well, that, yes, going to what we were talking about before, but there's, you know, there are other reasons that a kid might be in the crib. You know, the whole Dr. Ferber method was let the kid cry it out. It sounds like, based on today's understanding, that would be just like the worst thing to do. And many of us did that.
Yeah. Although I think then I go back to this idea of good enough parenting, you know, that, and there's a lot of research shows this. Fortunately, we don't need to be A+ parents. We need to get like a B-C+. Meaning like it's okay if
I'm gonna tell that to my kids.
Yeah, it's okay. And I think that's because, you know, the baseline resilience of humans is high. You know, for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, life has been incredibly hard on this planet. And we are the survivors, we are the progeny of some badass people who have been through Black Death and wars and cholera and smallpox. And so I think, you know, it's can be comforting to realize that actually we are very strong. Our children are strong. So back to the Ferber thing, I think in general, like if, as long as kids are getting love and compassion much of the time, if they're crying it out in their crib some of the time, that's probably not going to cause them untoward damage. But that said, some kids are orchids. I think I love this idea of sort of the dandelion orchid continuum that
my wife did a whole series of podcasts on that. And
yeah,
you got some of the big names on that. Yeah, the HSPs,
Right, right. So you can imagine an orchid kid crying it out in the crib every night. That might do real damage. The little dandelion kid might be fine with that. And that goes back to this idea that our kids each need, it'd be great if we all came with an operating manual.
Absolutely.
We have to figure it out for each.
Can you undo that damage? I mean, I guess I'm going off script over here, but can you like when they're young and because we now have more information, is so much more available than it's ever been. And I realize, okay, I've been doing X and Y. Let me just hug the heck out of them, take them out to pizza every day, really build up those connections. Can I rewire their brains still at a very young age?
Yeah, I think the jury's still out on that. I think that's dependent on sort of the temperamental personality characteristics of the kid, the nature of the attachment trauma. I think there's that whole body of research around the orphan Eastern European orphanages and kids just basically left in those cribs and given a bottle, and many of them were adopted, and some of them have seemed to do okay and many of them have not.
Let me ask you, as a Jew, Orthodox Jew who comes from generations of struggle, from the Holocaust to the Inquisition, do you believe in the intergenerational trauma effects? Mm-hmm. Let's say my parents were wonderful, but my grandparents, were in a Nazi death camp. Mm-hmm. This is curiosity.
I definitely do. In fact, I think on two levels. One is just being raised by grandparents or parents who are traumatized, how can that not affect you? But two, there's some really interesting research on epigenetics and how genetic expression of people when they're traumatized, it changes the way genes get expressed, and that actually can get passed down to generations, which is
so finally we create a genetic problem, a genetic problem is created, and now the next generation has that genetic predisposition to A or B or C.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's at least two mechanisms that trauma could be passed down generation to generation. And one of the things that I try to point out to many of my patients is a lot of my patients have had terrible childhood trauma and will be in my office, crying like, what have I done with my life? Or really, am I always going to suffer this trauma? And most of them, I can honestly point out and say, look at your kids. You broke the trauma cycle. You did the hardest thing of all, because many of these folks, the trauma is just, the sexual abuse generation to generation, generation. And then so many people I work with have broken that cycle. And I say, look, if the only thing you ever accomplished on this earth was you broke the trauma cycle in your family, what an amazing gift.
Bravo. I love that. That's a super encouraging thing to hear. That's really great to hear, we're going to get to this in a few moments, but many, if not the most of the people who listen to this podcast are fairly young families, just starting their families out, and they need to hear optimistic, uplifting messages, not only, the war stories. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about exercise. I know exercise is super important. You mentioned it earlier. Interestingly, I always saw my father exercising from as long as I can remember. So I've become an exerciser, not that you could tell by looking at me, but let's just say it would be a lot worse. And now as my kids are growing up, so my oldest three have joined gyms or are doing other exercise regimens in their life, and I love it. So they've learned by watching, because you can talk till you're blue in the face. Let's talk about the positive effects of exercise and then the negative effects of just really not doing the exercise.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. When you look at what are physically, emotionally, psychologically healthy people invariably doing? They're connecting, they're loving, they're finding meaning in their lives, they're moving, they're getting up after shortly after the sun comes up, they are, outdoors. And yet, what are we seeing in 2021 all over the world? People are staying up late, they're not out in nature, they're not moving their bodies. And so I think it is, when we move our bodies, one of my favorite books is Born to Run. I don't know if you know that book, but the thesis of that book is that we have been running ever since there were humans. And in fact, the way we used to hunt on the savannas of Africa is we would do these 2 to 4 day runs where we'd chase down any animals, because over a long period of time, over days, no animal on earth runs better than humans. We're the greatest runners over ultra distances. And so, but I think, and I see this with my patients too. Like, I have a patient who struggles with horrible depression, but when he goes hunting every fall, his depression goes away because he gets up early in the morning. He walks miles and miles. He's with his friends. He's in nature. He has to focus, and all his cares and worries go away because he's just looking for the deer or elk. And then he comes back home and he falls back into his life and his depression overwhelms him again. And I have a lot of examples like that, that it's like he's getting back to his core roots of being, doing what humans do, which is like, what have we done for most of our history? We got up with the sun. We were out in nature. We were moving. We were connected. We were focused on important things that mattered. And that's just not the way most of us are living right now. And then, you know, we can get into all the very specific benefits of exercise. I mean, a ton of research shows that for mild to moderate depression, exercise is as good as anything. Now, severe depression is a different thing, because I think trying to get people to exercise when they're severely depressed is like having them jump over a building. Like, that's not going to happen. But I think it's a good marker. Hold on. Exercise elevates the mood, it improves sleep quality. It bolsters the immune system. It improves your energy. It's seemingly the only thing we know for sure that helps stave off dementia. And, I think it's just, especially in this, I don't mean for this to sound sexist, I don't think it is, but I think even more than women, men got to move. Because what I see in my practice every day is that men, if they don't move their bodies, they go to substances. And it could be food. Like some of my men go to carbs, but I would say my men who exercise are mostly able to stay away from substances, but the ones who don't, alcohol and weed. And I think, again, if you look like through most of human history, what have men been doing? We've been, hunting and fighting and farming and doing stuff. And like, but what do I do all day? I sit on my butt all day. It's just so unnatural the way we're living. We are animals, but we don't. I think when we live more like animals and we move and we're out in nature and we are connecting, we're tribal, like that's our nature.
Awesome. I want to jump into the addiction stuff in just a second, but just as an add-on to the exercise thing, if I was a kid in today's day and age, I am 100% sure that I'd be diagnosed with ADHD. It just wasn't that big a deal when I was a kid. They gave you a whack and said, just go do your thing, or they ignored it. And somehow you figure it out. I drink a lot of coffee, as you're seeing over here, and I exercise, and my wife's learned that about me. She's like, if you're antsy, she's like, just go out for a run, go to the gym, go, blow off some steam and you come back home happy. Is there a component of that as a, non-medicinal treatment of ADHD?
For sure. Yeah, there's interest. And this is actually true both with kids with ADD, ADHD, and kids without ADHD, is that if you have them run around, get their blood pumping, get their heart pumping, they learn better. And there's all sorts of interesting research on this. And it's all kids. But kids with ADD, ADHD seem to benefit even more. So there's something about exercise that improves focus for everyone and improves ability to learn and retain information for everyone. But it's even more prominent for people with ADD, ADHD. Kind of reminds me, I had a dear friend who had bad ADHD as a kid, but it wasn't a thing when I was growing up. It wasn't even a diagnosis, but he was diagnosed later. And when he went to law school, he asked for permission to pace back and forth in the lecture hall during lectures. And then he got permission during the exams for every, I think, 10 or 15 minutes to be able to go walk around the building quickly, a few laps, because he's a super brilliant guy, but he's just so ADHD. But the moving his body would help him get like 10, 12 minutes of being able to focus. Then he'd go and walk around and move.
Oh, yeah. I totally get that. I honestly think they should do that in my kids in grade school. I would love for them to get up every 20 minutes and just run around the school and come back. And I think everyone would do better with that.
They'd do better. Yeah.
I want to talk about you kind of were just leading to that a moment ago, the integration between mental health and substance abuse. Would it be fair to say that the vast majority, if not the majority or all people who are who are abusing some form of drug, substance, food, addictive behavior is a result of a underlying mental health challenge?
I think you could say that almost everybody self-medicating with substances, including food, is trying to self-soothe or self-modulate. And then some subset of those people actually have bona fide mental health or mental illness issues. Again, it's tempting to want to say all or nothing. Let's just use an example with alcohol. Plenty of people come home after work and have a couple drinks to calm down, to kind of self-medicate their stress. And that's not necessarily problematic. Do they have a mental health problem? Not necessarily. Is it problematic use? Probably not if they're being mindful of it. Other people are using alcohol as a way to try to self-treat their depression or bipolar disorder, ADHD, or trauma, or schizophrenia. You know, I know when I meet with people for initial evaluation, if they're not abusing substances, I'm amazed. Like, I'll often high five people. Like, if they're not, I was like, give me a high. Because it's just, if you're really suffering mentally, emotionally, psychologically, substances work. I mean, they work at first, but you know, you want to change the way you feel, you know, cocaine or alcohol or kratom or oxycodone. I mean, you will very quickly change the way you feel. And so it's not surprising that people who are really suffering mentally, emotionally go to substances. And it's because they work at first. You know, how many people, you know, if you go to AA meeting, and you will definitely hear people say, you know, I didn't think I could do my life until I found alcohol. And then I knew I could do life. Right. And that worked for a while. Or fill in the sub, you know, I've had patients say, I never knew happiness, you know, until I found oxycodone. I never thought I could deal
or even pot.
I've
heard people say that that was the first time I ever felt normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or I never thought I'd be able to talk to people until I did substance X or substance Y. So, you know, occasionally I meet psychiatrists who say, oh, I don't do dual diagnosis, meaning, you know, substance and mental illness. And I think that's, luckily there aren't many of them. I think that is insane. Like, who are those people? Like, you only treating Mormons with schizophrenia? I mean, substance abuse and mental illness are completely wrapped up with each other. And what's been, and you and I emailed a little bit about this before, but what we're seeing in Colorado is actually really interesting, because with the advent of initially medical marijuana and now recreational marijuana, there's been an arms race to come up with the most powerful strains of weed. So, you know, when I was in high school and college in the 80s, marijuana was 3-5% by weight THC. Now you can walk into any dispensary in Colorado, get 28-40%, or you just get straight up pure THC oil. And as I've described in my podcast, that's a little bit like, you know, the difference between the weed of the 80s and now is kind of like the difference between beer and Everclear. I mean, they're both alcohol, but they're not the same thing. You know, if someone had told me 15 years ago that I would regularly see people in terrible psychosis from marijuana, I would have said that's not possible. Never saw that in residency, never saw that in med school, never saw that when I first moved here. But with the advent, again, of really potent strains of marijuana that have high THC and low CBD, and CBD, I think of as the brakes, if THC is the accelerator, CBD is the brakes. You get these really potent strains of cannabis that are flipping people regularly into psychosis.
So is that what is known as cannabis-induced psychosis?
Yeah.
Or is that just a fancy term that doesn't really mean anything?
No, it is. It's definitely a thing. And fortunately, most people who flip into psychosis from cannabis, as long as they quit using, it will resolve. But it's so frustrating. I think this comes back to this whole idea of medical marijuana, which I'm greatly opposed to. I mean, I've spoken at length about how I wish they would just have recreational marijuana, because I think there's real danger, at least psychiatrically, and talking about medical marijuana, because people think, oh, this is my medicine. I'm going to treat my manic depression with weed. I'm going to treat my depression. No. I mean, you might numb yourself. You might it might help you dial down some of this worst of the symptoms, but the long-term effects are going to make things worse. Similar to alcohol. I mean, alcohol works for depression and anxiety at first until it flips and makes things way worse. But I think it's not a good message that we're sending kids, for example, to have this whole idea of medical marijuana. Again, I'm speaking in the psychiatric sense, because it almost makes it sound like it's healthy. Like the dispensaries in Colorado will often have these green crosses, like green cure, you know, green medicine, or the health way, or these things. And I think, fine, you know, in my mind, fine if people want to smoke weed. I don't have a problem with that. But if you have bona fide psychiatric illness, you should not be using most forms of marijuana, particularly these high THC strains. Like, you're putting yourself at risk of flipping into mania and psychosis and panic and exacerbating your underlying mental illness. So we see this all the time now.
Let me interrupt you on that line. I want you to keep talking, but I want to just ask on that very thing. Is it only dangerous? Because I know so many people who wake up in the morning to pot and go to bed with pot.
Yeah.
And they're living great, successful lives, and they don't seem to be flipping out. Is it only if you have an underlying mental health challenge that it'll bring it out or make it explode or whatnot?
Yeah, we don't fully understand that, but the best evidence we have so far is that, yeah, you need an underlying genetic predisposition towards drug-induced psychosis. But the problem is we don't know how to test for that right now. So
for an underlying issue.
Yeah.
So that may never come out.
Right. So what what percentage of my patients smoke weed? I don't know, half or two thirds.
You're in Colorado. So
yeah. So I'm always talking to people about harm reduction. You know, like, look, if you're going to smoke weed, please like use lower THC strains, higher CBD, just be mindful of it. Sort of like my problematic drinkers. I'm just always urging them, please drink beer, not vodka. Please drink beer, not tequila, because it does matter the quantity of, you know, the potency of the drug. I've devoted a couple episodes to the whole weed issue, and you know, it's really hard, because I think the point you make is that, you know, the vast majority of people can use marijuana and not get psychotic. That's great. But what if you are one of those people who does, and you look around and you see, wait, all these people smoke and they're doing fine. And so I spend a lot of time with people trying to convince them that their 3 or 4 or 6 hospitalizations or their 2 or 3 times in jail are because they smoke weed. I'm like, why? That can't be. There can't. And then finally, most of them, after running that experiment long enough, realize, oh yeah, every time I smoke, I end up hospitalized. Or every time I smoke, I end up in jail.
Yeah. All right. We live in 2021, you know, head into 2022. You know, there is more mental health challenges that people are dealing with. In a perfect world, we can get a real thorough diagnosis. The reality is the Dr. Craig Hickox of the world are fewer and far between and harder to get appointments with, et cetera. So people are going, you know, whether it's their primary care physician giving them, you know, mental health medications, or the checklist pharmacologists and psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. But what should be the ideal, you know, route that a person's taking? In other words, there are tons of medicines out there. If you want to know a lot of categories, a lot of SSRIs and MAOIs and benzos and I'm sure I'm missing another dozen acronyms, all these things help. But, you know, of course, some people need to be on medications forever. But if you're, we'll just call it, there is no average, but if you're the more average struggler, we'll call it, and you're dealing with, you know, basic depression, basic anxiety, you know, is the goal for the medication to be, you know, something to get you over the hump, but really work it out in therapy, get to the root of the trauma? You know, what is the right, you know, path that a person ought to be looking for? Yeah. Medication as a means, etc.
So a couple ways to think about that. One is, I like to think in metaphor and images, and I'll often just say to people, you know, if we think of your mental health as a garden, you know, we might think of medications as fertilizer. The fertilizer might be really helpful, but even if we put the perfect fertilizer in the garden of you, is that going to grow a beautiful garden? No, you have to work the garden. You have to get out there and make changes and put effort into it. And that is sleep. And that is, using substances mindfully, if you're going to use them, that is connecting, that is loving, that is finding either work or purpose or engagement, that, you know, I think the tendency is to think of, oh, you have depression, you take depression meds, or anxiety, you take anxiety meds. But I try to encourage people, like, if this is the jigsaw puzzle of your mental health, like, meds very well may be a key central piece, but that is not the only piece. And if you're going to rely just on that, it's not going to go well. And then this whole, it's interesting, a lot of people come to me and say, oh, my goal is to not be on medications. And I always push back on that. And I say, really, is that your goal? Or is the goal to feel and function well? And that, and then they'll usually admit that. And that brings up the question of how long people need to be on medications. I mean, one way to answer that question is, you know, a really important factor in any medical visit is how long you've had a symptom. So if you show up at a doctor with an injured ankle or a rash or hearing problem, one of the questions they're always going to ask is, how long have you had this problem? So if you've had a bad knee for 20 years, you're probably going to have a significant knee issues into the foreseeable future versus if you twisted your knee last week. So people come in my office and say, you know, I really fell apart when I was 10. Now they're 40 years old. And I think, okay, it's been 30 years. This is probably someone who's going to be on medications indefinitely versus, you know, someone who comes in and says, yeah, the last 6 months things fell apart. But before that, the rest of my life, I was good. Then I think, oh, if they go on medications, this is someone who could probably do them for 3, 6, 9 months. So time course matters. And it also really matters what people are willing to commit to. So here's a good example. I have people who have relapsing psychotic illness who use a lot of weed. And I tell them, if you would stop using weed, I think we could get you off your antipsychotic. And a number of them have said, no.
Not worth it. They won't make it.
It's not worth it. Right. No, it's interesting. Yeah. A number of, especially they're usually men, and they say, I'll take my antipsychotic every day so I can smoke weed.
Wow.
It's worth it. And then other people, I have actually other people who have decided, okay, I will make the hard choices of being really good with my sleep and staying away from substances so I can come off my antipsychotic. And most of them do well. So I think it's also, you know, what kind of lifestyle choices are people willing to make? Like, how badly do they want to get off meds?
Wow. Let me kind of pick up, you know, piggyback on that a little bit. You know, do you think, again, there are certain things that people with all the best efforts in the world will never be able to accomplish on their own. But, you know, I'm hesitant to name specific, you know, diagnoses because I'm just not an expert on the topic. But, you know, let's take a bipolar disorder or severe depression. If someone wants it enough, Do you, with the aid of medication for maybe a period of time or maybe forever, do you think that if you truly want it enough mentally, you know, that you're ready to do the work, the therapy, the exercise, all the more, we'll call it, some will say that the pot is natural, but the more natural roads that we really could work our way through many psychological illnesses? When people just don't want to do the work, so they're just, let me just medicate it down.
Yeah, I think you're not going to like this answer, right? I'll say it depends.
So that's a very Jewish answer.
Yeah. So here's, well, let's just use bipolar disorder. So I think of bipolar disorder as a huge tent, and I often tell people, like, here's where you are in the bipolar tent. So the middle of the tent are the manic depressives that get fully, like, psychotically manic and spend tens of thousands of dollars and drive 100 miles an hour in the freeway and hook up with prostitutes and fight cops and, you know, get really out of control. And then as you go out, you get to the very edges of the bipolar spectrum, people who kind of have a seasonal, cyclical depressive illness that maybe is pretty well manageable with sleep hygiene and behavioral stuff. So you could have someone with the same diagnosis, bipolar. You take two people, but the severity of illness really matters. And surprise, surprise, the trauma history really matters. So, and substance use. And yeah. And so that said, I know people who have what I would describe as pretty severe mental illness who have really doubled down and changed their life and are on little to no medications. And I have a lot of other people who have done everything I've asked, everything. And they still have to be on sometimes multiple medications so they don't get suicidal or don't end up hospitalized. And I think this, one of the things I love about psychiatry is it's super complicated and rich and mysterious, but that's also, I think, frustrating on the patient's end because there's just so many factors that play into it. But again, another really good reason to work with someone who really knows you, who sees you as a person, not as a diagnosis or, you know, as a list of symptoms.
That's, yeah, totally makes sense. You know, it would be nice if mental health challenges were like a broken arm. You know, you look at the x-ray and, oh, I know exactly what I need to do. This seems, there is a lot more guessing and a lot more variables that we just can't control. So it's like you said, fun for the curious psychiatrist, less fun for the patient.
Yeah.
All right, we're basically out of time. Leave us with a positive, uplifting message or maybe guidance. You know, a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are younger families with younger kids, you know, things to look out for, you know, things that people can do to, you know, create a better outcome, or if they see things kind of starting to go the wrong direction, what might they be able to do? I know I'm throwing a lot at you in this, leave us with a message of hope.
Yeah. Well, I'd say a few pieces of hope. Number one, 2021, this is the best time in the history of humans to have a mental illness. I mean, we have amazing treatments. We understand so much more. That say what you will about all the things that are going badly in the world, there are really good treatments out there and there's amazing things on the horizon, number one. Number two is, you know, there's a big generational shift now in how we talk to kids. I can't tell you how many of my patients say when they were growing up, nobody talked about how they were feeling or trauma or substance use. So, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, people just didn't, they loved their kids a lot, but, you know, it was more feral parenting then. People just kind of ran wild. But now I think it's very normal in so many families to just openly talk with your kids about, hey, you know, why dad doesn't drink? Like, dad was an alcoholic. Let's talk about that. Or, hey, when I was your age, I was really sad and I even got suicidal. And so it's interesting hearing my patients talk about opening up with their kids about substance stuff and mental health stuff. It's so helpful for the kids because they feel like, really, mom? And I've seen that in my office where, you know, a high school girl will break down crying, describing what she's going through. And then the mom will start to tear up and she'll say, sweetie, that's what I went through as a teenager. And I just think, oh, that is so great that we're just so much more open and connected with our kids. You know, I think some would argue that we're over-involved, but, you know, and my patients often worry that their kids are going to inherit some of their mental illness, mental health vulnerability. And I say they might, but what they also have is they have an expert. They have someone who cares, who's going to do it differently. Because, you know, again, so many of my people describe growing up and telling their parents that they were sexually abused by a babysitter or something bad happened or that they were feeling really sad and the parents didn't know what to do and just sort of left it hanging. Just wanted my kids to know. And I try to model this too with the families I work with. Like, it's just talk, like put it out there. I think when kids know that it's okay to talk about whatever, like they can bring stuff up and the parents can just listen and like, okay, thank you for bringing that up. This is a safe place.
I agree with you. I think the world has, I mean, I don't know your age, but we're probably pretty close to the same age. There's no question that we can talk about things that we're not able to be talked about before. And I think, you know, it's if you look at Hollywood, it's almost cool. It's in vogue to have, you know, they call it, you know, someone's going to the hospital to rest. They're suffering from exhaustion. I'm like, I suffer from exhaustion every day. But, you know, that's like code for I'm depressed, I'm anxious, I'm worried, I'm stressed. You know, it's okay to talk about these things where it really wasn't previously. And in that, I agree with you. We've made huge strides. And in the Jewish community and the Orthodox Jewish community, you know, we're moving at lightning speed. And I think that's awesome. And all right, any parting shots?
No, this was really, really fun. I'm glad we did this. Thank you.
Well, thanks for agreeing to come on for this. Technical question. People can follow you at?
Yeah, so my personal website and for the podcast is craighecockmd.com, craighecockmd.com. And Back from the Abyss is on Instagram, and you can find it on all the podcast platforms. And maybe don't start with episode one, season one, strawberries. That's a five chili episode. Maybe save that to see if you're someone who likes the heavy, darker stuff. But you know, there's all sorts of lighter episodes. There's episodes on there where I just give mini talks on different topics. So I think if you're interested in mental health, mental illness, and recovery and hope, I think Back from the Abyss has something for everyone.
I agree. I think that it's an excellent, excellent podcast. Do you do telehealth? Or are you taking on new patients, or are you filled to the gills?
I'm pretty full. Yeah, very, very intermittently. I sometimes have room for people who are doing ketamine treatment for depression. But this is the busy time of the year in mental health. This is what I call tax season, basically. Halloween to Christmas is the when people really fall apart.
Interesting. Connected to the holidays? Why do you think that
connected is? To a couple of things. One is the seasonal onset or worsening of depressive syndromes, particularly bipolar. Also, a lot of people give up their healthy habits in the fall, winter. They give up working out and they drink and smoke more. That does not help. And then another thing is holidays are really hard for a lot of people because either A, they don't get to be with their families, or B, they have to be with their families.
All right, that's good stuff.
So it's, yeah. And then, you know, if you're, let's say you're sober and you're trying not to drink and now it's Thanksgiving, now it's Christmas. I mean, holidays are hard for people. Yeah. I know my mom's a therapist. I was bemoaning a few years ago. I said, oh, Christmas is the worst. I said, everybody suffers so much at Christmas. She said, Craig, not everybody suffers at Christmas. It's like everyone I know does, which is sad, but kind of true in mental health.
Yeah, but I get what you mean. All right. Well, thank you so much for this. This was great. And I will tag you in the, you know, when we publish this, we'll tag you. Everyone go follow him. Go follow Craig on Instagram. He just opened his account a few days ago. Let's get him 1,000 followers fast. All right. Take care. Thanks a million for doing this.
Yeah. Thank you.